Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. YouTubers, hi. Like, subscribe, bell, comment. We will make sure we include you next week. Trust me on that. Nikias, it's time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up. Time to hoop it up indeed. Going to be a little theme-centric on this episode of the podcast. We had a couple of marquee matchups over the weekend. The Celtics taking on the Nuggets. We got a Western Conference Finals preview, question mark, with the Wolves and the Thunder. So I figured, hey, let's talk a little bit about those games since those were a lot of fun. Playoff feels to both. But use those games as an avenue to kind of check in on these four teams as they do project as contenders right now. So we'll talk about our confidence level, any potential questions that we have, moves that you think we should make, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll dig into those. Before getting into Boston-Denver, I had a general question for you, Steve, as someone that coached in the league. So when it comes to games like these where you're facing like someone that's high up in your conference, something like that, do you kind of feel the, because I know from the outside you'll get the this is a playoff feel or this is a playoff preview, et cetera. Like in the coaching room, do you feel that at all? Do you care about that portion of it? Is there any extra oomph to prep heading into games like that? Like just during the regular season, are you more inclined to go to some of these playoff adjustments? Are you hiding stuff? Or like how do you kind of approach a quote-unquote bigger regular season matchup?
I mean, it depends. Depends on how good you are, how good they are. When does it line up during the season? Is it the second night of a back-to-back? Is it the first night of a back-to-back? Have we played them before? Is it the first time we're playing them? Is this a player that we feel like we have to game plan for? Is the team we feel like our base could be strong enough for? There's a lot of different variables that go into it. So, yes, there may be a team where it's like we need to double this guy. There may be times where it's like, okay, we need to watch out for this, this, and that. But I think our base should be able to get it done. If they start get going, maybe we adjust to doubling or we show and recover. You keep things in your back pocket, but you keep it business as usual. You know, you keep your same confidence level. You go in there approaching it as just another game. Even though there may be excitement around it, a win is a win, a loss is a loss. So you're trying to get it done any way you can.
Okay, got you. Figured out how to ask. Let's dig into this Boston-Denver game. A 102-100 victory for the Denver Nuggets. Jokic with a near triple-double, 34-12-9. Jamal Murray with 35 in this one. Jason Tatum, Kristaps Porzingis, Derek White all above 20 points, but not the most efficient nights for Tatum or Brown in this one. I think for me, just to quickly go through this, I thought this was a stamp game for Denver's defense. Like there was a lot of conversation around Boston's offense, and I have some questions for you on that front as well, late game offense in particular. But this really felt like a very loud, Denver can still do this. And they've been around like top 10 defensive rating for most of the year anyway, 10 to 12, 10 to 13, somewhere in there. But I was really impressed with what we saw from them defensively. Cycling through coverages with Nikola Jokic, cycling through matchups with Nikola Jokic, like seeing him on Jrue Holiday, saw him on Kristaps. They moved him around the chessboard, asked him to do different things. Aaron Gordon taking on Jaylen Brown assignment, switching on Jason Tatum sometimes as well. I had a lot of fun watching them kind of lock into what Boston was trying to do and throwing different looks at them and cycling through those. The other thing that kind of went in my mind as I was watching this game, it took me back to the New Year's resolution episode. We were talking about Denver and I brought up Zeke Nagy. It's like, hey, heading into the new year, I would love to see him just snatch some minutes or really solidify himself as that backup five for Denver. Because I think come playoff time, as of, you know, when we recorded that early January, it's like, I feel like as of right now, he probably isn't going to factor into the playoff rotation right now. Because I don't think he's shown enough defensively. I would like the screen to be better. I'd like him to be more of a pressure point offensively, things like that. Sure enough, we get to this Boston game. Season high, 41 minutes for Aaron Gordon. He is the backup five. We don't see Zeke Nagy. So that was just like a quick thought. But for me, it was very much Denver's defense stepping up in this one. The Jokic-Murray two-man game was incredible. And for Boston, like it shed another light on the late-game offense, though honestly, it felt like for me they did a little too much late versus the general Boston is stagnant. We're just going to ISO all the time. It felt like they cycled through things where they really didn't have to. Were kind of my primary takeaways from that one. What stood out to you in this Nuggets-Celtics game?
Yeah, most of it. But for me, it was Denver's defense. I think the one thing we need to talk about more as the season progresses, as we get closer to the playoffs, is Denver's versatility defensively. And I think for me, that's a strong word sometimes, especially because versatility is so key as far as winning in this league, but it's something that Denver is really nailing and really trusting. And you look at this Denver-Boston game, as you noted, they flipped matchups, they flipped coverages, but how they did it and when they did it and how they trusted it was so key to me. With Denver, you know about Jokic being at the level in pick and roll, Denver rotating behind it. Last year in the playoffs, they showed a willingness to keep Jokic in a drop in certain series. We talked about the backup 5 minutes. It just turned into Aaron Gordon and Jeff Green. So, hey, we can go smaller. We can switch. We can do different things. Denver being able to have multiple things in their back pocket is just so key for them to navigate different series, to navigate different moments. I think they displayed that in that Boston game. And it's not something that is new, particularly this one, because they did it against the Sixers as well, where, hey, Nikola Jokic, you guard Kelly Oubre, you guard Patrick Beverley, let's put you on a guard. And you go back to this Boston game, Jokic starts on Porzingis. We start with two on the ball against Jason Tatum. We go to a drop and a late switch against Kristaps Porzingis to try and take away the pop. Then in that same quarter, let's flip the matchups. Nikola Jokic, you're on Jrue Holiday. And then, hey, you guys made a sub. Okay, Jokic, you're back on Porzingis. Let's put two on the ball, but let's pre-rotate to that pop. And just in that section, that spectrum of the first quarter, they have gone ahead and said, we're going to dictate terms. This is what we're giving up. And I think that was part of the reason why Boston found it at times. But they couldn't consistently hit it because Denver kept moving the target defensively. And I think, to me, I give Jokic credit because I think there's a couple things that they have done and he has done a better job of. More possessions where Jokic is one pass away. I think they had a post-up for Jason Tatum. Jokic is one pass away. I'm showing help. I'm closing back out to Jrue Holiday. I'm keeping the ball in front. That's different than what we've seen before. Even when they went to the second half and they dipped back into it, one of the things that Denver does a really good job of, when Jokic is spaced and his man is in the corner and he shows help on a roll, Denver does a great job of flying around him. So, hey, Jokic, you take the roll. I'm KCP. I'm getting out to the corner. We've protected Jokic. So basically, we've gotten him back on a big without forcing him to be in the first pick and roll coverage. Mm-hmm. And just little things like that. Even Boston tried to adjust, I think, to make Jrue Holiday a screener to get Jokic in the action. And Jokic stood in a drop. Stayed contained against Tatum, contested. I think there was one play where he switched and Reggie Jackson was like, what are you doing? What do you want me to do? And Jokic was like, hey, don't worry about it. I got Derek White. Let me go ahead and continue to contest that. That was huge. The other part of it for me was the play of Jokic and Jamal Murray. It never felt like Boston felt comfortable with how they wanted to defend Jamal Murray. I think it was a reminder of how important Jamal Murray was last year during that championship run. Like it felt like he was okay with the matchups. Boston threw a lot of drop at him, and he just turned the corner, made some tough shots. I just felt like he kept the pressure on them in a different way. And where Boston, who has had the defensive tricks, they've showed them against different teams this year, couldn't necessarily nail that one down. Do we want to switch? We don't really want to switch. So we're not going to switch. They had a couple moments when they had the double big lineup where it felt good, but Jamal Murray was able to lead the dance. Jokic was able to lead the dance. They were able to keep them hanging around. Now that defense comes, and that's where that belief kicks in. We're still in it. We can get stops. We can score. But we're going to keep playing. And so I think for me, it was more of a hat tip for Denver than a what's going on with Boston type game. Although there are some questions.
There are some questions indeed. Just quickly to bounce off of how Boston tried to defend Denver. Like it did feel like, to the Jokic portion in particular, because you were right on it with Jamal Murray, and he has proven when he's been healthy over the past few years, like he is such a barometer for what they do offensively. We know Jokic can get his, for lack of a better way to phrase it. If Jamal Murray is also knocking down these shots off the dribble and mixing in these cuts and flying off of handoffs, mixing in the post-ups against smaller players, if you can't get a handle on Jamal Murray and you also can't do anything with Nikola Jokic, it's going to be tough sledding for you. But with how Jokic was defended in particular, like I was intrigued very early in that game. Because it felt like Boston's like, nah, we're just going to go one-on-one. Kristaps, do your best. We don't want to open things up. And I remember tweeting out like midway through the first quarter. It's like, okay, Jokic just kind of having his way with Kristaps right now. He scored on the block. He's scoring efficiently. He only has one assist. And to that point of the game, Denver had taken 1-3. I was like, okay, Boston's not in rotation. They're kind of living with this. And then as Denver got into some of their subs, Christian Brown comes in, Peyton Watson comes in, Jokic get a post touch. Okay, now here comes help. Now here comes a double. And so, like, I appreciated the nuance there. I do kind of wonder, as the game continued to go on, was it worth ramping up the pressure against Jokic in an effort to at least try to take away one of him and Murray? Because as we got to the end of the game, it felt like both of them were just on at that point. And though it got really slow for both teams, like, it wasn't a high-scoring affair as we got in the clutch time. Again, we'll talk about Boston's offense. But it did feel like overall, okay, Jamal Murray feels it. Jokic also feels it. Now he's got to hope we can get timely stops and make him pay on the other end. Like, how did you feel about Boston's plan against Jokic in that one?
I mean, I got the idea. As far as everyone stay at home, let's defend Jokic, let's not double. I think the thing for me was more so what was behind it. What was the adjustment? What was the next thing? Did you have something in the bag you felt comfortable with? Was it switching? Was it doubling? I think they may have doubled one or two times off the top of my head. Jokic hits a great pass back to Murray off a double team, and now you don't go back into it. So for me, it was more just like, I don't know if they had an idea for how to disrupt them, which is odd because Boston's very good at A, doing that, and they have the personnel. So I felt like it was a very interesting balance for Boston to toe defensively, where they have this strong personnel where you trust people to go one-on-one so you don't have to show help and you can tilt matchups. But what happens when you don't do that? What happens when guys are in rhythm? Do you now feel as comfortable hitting those double teams? When are you going to hit those double teams? Do you want to put two on the ball in those scenarios? And I think for me, it was less the doubles and more just some of the resistance on Murray's paint touches just didn't feel like Boston adjacent, if that makes sense. With their personnel, with their ability to navigate screens, with the size they tend to have, it didn't feel great. I think they tried zone. I want to say the first zone possession, at least in the fourth quarter, I remember Jamal Murray just turns the corner and dunks and gets an and one. And so it's just like, okay, we're deploying different things. Do we have the great purpose for it and the right timing? So it kind of felt like one of those where you would feel different. I think it would be differently if it was a playoff setting. I'll put it that way.
Okay, I got you. And then flipping to the other end for Boston, because I think the loudest portion from Boston's side anyway, exiting the game, was last 4 or 5 minutes of the game, they got a basket. Or they got 2 points. They weren't able to do anything from there. I guess, what did you see from Boston's late game offense? Was that, you know, circling back to what you said earlier, more of a hat tip to what Denver was doing? Or do you feel like there was some stuff left on the table for Boston there?
I mean, my mind wasn't really on just specifically the last 4 or 5 minutes. I mean, I know that's the narrative. I know everyone wants to go with, oh, they play slow. For me, it's overall, did Boston hit their pressure points in that game? Do you walk away thinking Denver felt the pressure of Jason Tatum? Do you walk away thinking that Jokic felt like he had to defend over and over and over again? And this is where I credit Denver's defense. They did a heck of a job of containing penetration, showing help and recovering and rotating. My disappointment with Boston wasn't necessarily just the fourth quarter. When they did get Jokic at the level, when they did get two on the ball, what did they get out of it? That's Boston's strength. We get you in rotation. We have all this space. We have all these shooters. We have guys who can drive as well. We can get points out of this. And there were a few possessions where they actually got Jokic back up to the level. Two dribbles, one pass, Denver recovers. That's it. That's where my concern level was. Now, if we're talking late game, for me, it is and will always be with this Boston team. When are they starting their sets? What options are they getting to? And how much have they done after that? If it's 14 on the clock and they're just getting to a pick and roll, hey, flip a coin. That's something they have to navigate and they're going to have to work through if they want to be a champion. But I was more disappointed with the overall direction as far as the pressure they put on Denver's defense.
I got you. And then just quickly bouncing off of that. I think that's one thing that kind of popped me, and I think I ended up tweeting about this the day after. You're getting two to the ballpoint. Like, it felt like there were a couple of possessions late in that fourth quarter to where Al Horford is your screener. Let's get Jokic in the action. Horford flips his angle at the last second. Jokic is on the wrong side of the screen. I was like, wait a minute. You might have found something. Get downhill, attack that. Jason Tatum gets downhill on one. He misses a layup. It could have been a foul. They don't call it. It's a very physical game. I think, 27 combined free throws in that game. So that was fun. But he gets downhill. He misses a layup. And I was like, okay, let's see if they go back to this. A little bit later is now Jaylen Brown is your ball handler. And they go to like this double pick and roll. And they kind of get the same thing with Horford flipping the angle late. But because Jokic, Gordon, and MPJ are in it, they're able to kind of switch their way out of it. And it's like, no. Go back to, even if you're going to use Jaylen Brown, like, no, get some good stuff out of that, play out of that. In addition to your point about the tempo stuff, like, it took a minute for them to get to it to begin with. And so, like, it was a weird thing for me watching Boston's offense. And I guess we can kind of zoom out from here. It's so funny watching them kind of oscillate between we are making quick decisions, we are doing the thing, we're doing what we need to do, we're putting pressure on defense, it's cool. And then random game X, it is they're walking it up, first screen comes at 12 seconds, it's one option, they make it a switch, and now it's ISO time. And then a game like Friday against Denver, there was some of the tempo stuff. They could have gotten to their offense a little bit quicker than they did. But it just felt like they were cycling through the playbook late in the fourth. And that was a time where, again, rare for me, but I was like, no, just honestly, I'd rather you just keep doing the same thing because you're getting good stuff out of this particular action or this particular exploit. Keep doing that until Denver shows we can adjust to this and then flow into something else. And it felt like they pressed the EJ button on like that in particular. And it kind of goes into your overall point about how much did Denver really feel Boston? Because it felt like even when they found something good, they didn't stick with it long enough for it to really be a pressure point. And I kind of wonder, as we get, you know, move to the second half of the year and eventually get to the playoffs with Boston, I guess what is the course of action to them finding that rhythm late in games? Because I think you look at their fourth quarter numbers, if you look at their clutch numbers in particular, they have one of the best offensive rates in the league in clutch time this year. It doesn't always feel like that. And so I wonder what is going to go into it actually starting to feel that way. Like, what is a pet set or pet action that they can lean into and feel good about getting into at 17 on the clock? Like, okay, we know for a fact we can run this and put defenses in a loop and we can play out of this. And we feel comfortable going to that versus them either just simplifying things and really slowing things down to get into this ISO post heavy style, or we're cycling through a whole bunch of stuff and we don't really have the flow that we need.
I think it's less about a pet set and a pet action and more just comfort. Comfort. They just got to get comfortable playing in these moments. And you mentioned the going back and forth. This is part of finding it, where you have this lineup that has so many offensive threats. Who is going to be used and when? We've seen them be able to go through Tatum. That doesn't work. They go through Jaylen Brown. That doesn't work. They go to Drew and Kristaps Porzingis. That works. And now, again, you can feel the weight of our lineup because, again, we have options. But how do you balance that with it feeling like it's taking turns? And the initial action doesn't actually matter if you handle it, because now we don't necessarily have the same connection points that we usually have because there's 12 on the clock. Or now Jason Tatum has decided to go one-on-one because, hey, I'm aggressive. I need to get in the paint, make something happen. Okay, good job. It's the balance for Boston for me. As far as understanding what they want to accomplish as a unit, they're going to have five guys who can get it done. For me, it's just about getting into it early and then having a purpose after the first set. That's the biggest thing for me.
Understood. And then zooming out with Boston, after that loss, their first home loss of the season, which is ridiculous to me that it took until midway through January for them to lose at home for the first time. They have the best record in the league, best record in the East. They're second in offense. They're third in defense. They're first in net rating right now. Again, there's plenty of discussion about the late game offense in particular. Aside from that, is there anything else that kind of raises the brow with you with Boston right now?
Ooh, what would raise the brow? Like, I mean, I guess their bench lineups, their rotation maybe? What's their closing lineup? Is it Drew? Is it Al?
I think back, we talked about this a little bit earlier. I think heading into the season, when we did the season previews, one of the questions posed was, what is going to be Boston's best lineup? Do you feel any closer to having that answer midway through the year?
Yes. They got two options. One of them has Allen there. One of them has Drew in there. Between Tatum, Brown, White, Porzingis probably going to be out there. It's just who's going to be the fifth. You can't really go wrong.
Yeah, like it was fun for me seeing Al out there, and then he ended up being, I think, a plus off the bench in this game as well. But I guess aside from, like, lineup stuff, just general tempo stuff offensively, like, one thing I floated out about a week and a half ago, keeping an eye on, like, Kristaps' three-point percentage and seeing where that lands as teams go into a playoff setting against Boston, knowing, okay, we can't take away everything. What can we live with? I wonder if it gets to a point against, with any team, if it gets to a point where, like, okay, not necessarily let Kristaps shoot, but, like, okay, this is the lesser of all the evils that we got to deal with here. And so, like, that's been at the back of my mind for a little bit. Beyond that, it's always going to be, well, not always, but beyond that, like, seeing what Jaylen Brown does with the ball in his hands in terms of decision-making, how quickly he's making those decisions. Shot selection with Tatum. But, like, other than that, like, they have been pretty much the best team in the league wire to wire so far this year. And so I don't have major concerns. Any twist for you at all, or any shift at all for you with their second unit, do you feel like they need to add anything? Because they've kind of been loosely mentioned around, like, trade rumors and stuff like that to add a piece.
What are they adding? What are they adding that they don't already have?
I guess another four option would be the only thing I could think of, really.
How many minutes are they going to get in the playoffs?
It would depend on who they get, but probably not anything substantial. As you mentioned, they have their top six that kind of cycle through in terms of closing lineups.
So I mean, I'm just asking. Much feel
okay. Like, oh, no, you're good. I'm just saying, like, that very much feels like a get us through the regular season more than anything, but also, like, to have that kind of optionality through the first two rounds. If you want to shift to something else, if someone gets hurt, or if there's some foul trouble, something that you feel comfortable with stepping in for minutes. But, like, I'm kind of with you. I don't think that's anything they need. They are very much entering, you know, the last week and a half, 2 weeks before the trade deadline expires. They're very much in a position of strength right now. They don't have to do anything.
I got a question for you then.
Okay.
What's more important for Boston when it comes to Porzingis? His defense or being able to use him to attack switches?
I may go with the offense, especially within the context of everything we just discussed with, like, the late game stuff and just having another option there. And even just from a pure shot profile standpoint, having someone that kind of dominate the mid post area and make defenses help from a different spot and put pressure on defense in a different way. Like, I think it's important if you can really establish Kristaps as that. And even then, he's still been one of the most efficient post options in the league this year. So, like, it's been there. But I do worry about if that slips, what does that mean? Does it go back to the conversation we've had with Boston the last couple of years where it's like, okay, we got the personnel, let's just switch and watch them bog down. I think Kristaps does have the ability to firmly take that off the table for a lot of teams, if not all teams, if he's dominant in that area. Would you lean with the offense or the defense for him?
Truthfully, they need both. They need to be able to trust that he can handle that drop against some of these elite guards or show a little bit of versatility. They didn't have to deal with that in this particular matchup, but that's something they'll have to conquer. And then they are going to face switches at some point, depending on the unit and the lineup. How comfortable are they with cycling through the options? I think one of the things about the Denver matchup is it didn't necessarily feel like they had one thing they knew they wanted to attack. Sometimes it was maybe Jamal Murray. Maybe let's put Jokic in here. Maybe it's Michael Porter Jr. But does it look different when they have a firm mindset on who they want to attack and what that opens up? I mean, ultimately, I just think they couldn't hit the same pressure points that we are used to them seeing or used to seeing them hit. And that kind of took some of the flow out of it.
Understandable. And then on the Denver side, like, for me, it is I'm keeping eyes on the bench with them moving forward and just seeing what kind of growth we continue to see from Peyton Watson, who took a lot of threes in the Boston game in particular, didn't shoot that well, but continue to keep an eye on how confident and how fluid those shot attempts are going to be. I'm glad he's not scared to take those. And once you add in the drives that he brings, the occasional offensive rebound, the defense is incredibly fun with him. I don't really have big questions about Peyton Watson. Again, it's been an uneven season for Christian Brown. I would like to see Denver add something to their bench or something that feels more consistent, more solid with the second unit. I don't know if that comes in the wing room or the guard room, but I'd probably feel a little bit better if they were able to add something. But beyond that, like, I think the defense is firmly good, and they showcased in that Boston game where we are in a playoff atmosphere. We can't shift the Gordon at the five. We can't move him around. We can do different things with Jokic. The defense can be high level enough, and the offense is, you know, around Murray and Jokic, it's a buzzsaw. So I don't have major questions outside of just keeping an eye on the bench, really. Did you have any concerns or any just general thoughts on Denver? You're just pretty much, they're the champs, they're going to be fine.
Well, no, that was a preview. You mentioned how the coaches approach it. That was a preview for you. Being able to throw out Jamal Murray, Reggie Jackson, KCP, Peyton Watson, Aaron Gordon, that was a preview. Mm-hmm. Peyton Watson, you are Jeff Green Jr. We got our Jokic lineups. A whole lot of people can play with Jokic. We got Jamal Murray plus the bench, and we'll probably involve Aaron Gordon as the five with Peyton Watson being able to guard multiple positions. They've laid the template down. It's just on them to be able to work through it and get back to it. So I think for me, it's okay. Can we get some more from Christian Brown as the season progresses? Can we maybe get some more from Zeke Nnaji as the season progresses? Other than that, we know what our core guys do. And we continue to work on the defensive end. Offensively, if we play the right way, we have high confidence what we do. I think that defensive versatility is what's going to be key. Now, the question for me, does their path matter? Do they need the one seed?
I don't think they need it. I feel like they can win anywhere, honestly. I don't think they need the one seed. I think they're firmly going to be a home court team unless the wheels fall off the cart somewhere or someone gets hurt. Then they're going to be a home court team. And ultimately, if they are on the road in a series against Minnesota or OKC, if they are, because I think Denver's three right now. If they end up on the road against OKC or Minnesota, whoever falls to two, I don't think they're going to be afraid to come into either of those buildings and snag one. They're going to have some pretty clear matchup advantages to pick at in either one of those matchups. So I don't think they need it. Can I ask you a very quick general Denver question for you before we move to the second game and the second pair of teams? How have you felt about Michael Porter Jr.'s season?
Good. He's working defensively. It's about all you can ask for. That's my meter for Michael Porter Jr. You?
I think it's been good overall. Like, probably a little bit louder just because of some of the shots he took in that Boston game where it's like, hey, we probably could have worked to get something else, or you could have got that a little bit later. But that's just part of the Michael Porter Jr. experience. Like, I haven't had major issues about his defense overall. There have been a couple of games throughout the year where it's like, hey, so he's on the weak side now. It feels like teams are putting him in help positions on purpose. Are we back to 2 years ago where teams are like, yeah, we can pick at him and get good stuff every time down? Or is this just a random game in December now? And it feels like it's trending more towards the latter, which is stark improvement from where it was early in the year. So, like, I haven't had a big issue, but like, I just wanted to get your thoughts because he isn't someone that we've talked about in depth this year. So I just want to see where you were.
I mean, look, for the month, he's averaging 17 points. He's shooting 54% from the field, 44% from three. If he's going to do that with some improved one-on-one defense and the weak side rotations aren't terrible, take what you get.
You take it. Like, he's such an important piece for them. Like, just for no other reason than the three-point volume. Like, he is kind of the guy that's going to get up 7 to 10 on any given night, and not, you don't have to think about it. Where with Jamal Murray, he can flow into pull-ups naturally. We know Jamal Murray can shoot, but he may put more pressure on the rim. Or it may be more of a rhythm deal with him. With MPJ, you have to account for where he is at all times. There's inherent value to that. And then defensively, you mentioned the rotations just need to be not awful. In part because he's so large. And you think about the collective front court of him, Aaron Gordon, and Jokic. With that much size, like, that shrinks the floor for you, even if you don't think MPJ or Jokic in particular are like elite defenders or anything of that sort. So if he can hold serve, he's going to be fine. And honestly, you know, no Bruce Brown on the bench this year. And hopefully we see a higher level of consistency for Christian Brown second half of the year. If neither, you know, if Brown in particular isn't able to handle it, like MPJ is just firmly going to be a closing player, I feel. Or I guess it'll be between him and Peyton Watson. So like that's, the importance is going to be even higher, especially if Peyton isn't able to knock down shots at a high clip. But it's been fine for me so far with MPJ. Let's shift to the second game, get to the second pair of teams, the Wolves and the Thunder. A 102-97 victory for the Thunder in this one. 33 for Shea and an incredibly fun fourth quarter for him. 20 for Jalen Williams, 15 for Chet. 19-5-5 for Ant. Didn't have the cleanest of nights. 5 turnovers for him. Chris Finch was not pleased with the Wolves. They 21 turnovers in this game. The fact that it was only 5, and they took a pretty big lead in the second half of that one. If they take care of the ball, they probably win that game, honestly. To have that many turnovers and to have the super rare Mike Conley makes a 3 game and to still be in it, that kind of speaks to how close that one was. But for me, I had a lot of fun watching this one. I was back home now, so I was in Chicago Saturday. Went to Bulls Grizzlies, which sounded like a much better game when that was originally planned than what it ended up being, considering Grizzlies are just missing a whole bunch of people, but that's neither here nor there. But didn't get to watch Wolves Thunder live. Digging into that one and seeing how the matchups were played with, seeing Anthony Edwards take Shea off rip was a lot of fun. Watching the Wolves get more and more frustrated with Shea drives as the game went on. Elicited a chuckle from me watching that one. But I think even beyond this game, it was a nice look into what OKC is going to face heading into the playoffs. So that was exciting for me. Minnesota, again, they've been the best defense in basketball all year long. And so there are some things and some players in particular that the Wolves can throw at the Thunder that other teams just cannot. But watching Jaden McDaniels on Chet raised the brow for me. And Rudy Gobert getting the Josh Giddey matchup so he can roam around. And very early on, as OKC jumps out to, I think, a 16-5 lead and it turned to a 21-5 lead early, the cutting popped so much in that game. So we're, okay, cool, let's go with this pick and roll. Y'all might want to switch. That's fine. If you want to play off of Josh Giddey, that's fine. They're moving Josh all over the court. And then depending on what Cat has to do as a helper, now here comes Jalen Williams just cutting all over the place. Is Josh Giddey relocating? And then you still have to worry about what Shea's doing with the ball if he has it. And I'm just like, they are working so hard to find these creases. And even when it feels like you're playing good defense, they're still able to get good stuff. That was encouraging. But what it also brought to mind with like Jaden McDaniels on Chet in particular, because we've been talking about Chet through the last couple of rookie reports. And we hopped on JJ, talked about the rookie of the year race, etc. How impressed we've been collectively with the drives from Chet. That game Saturday felt like a very loud, oh, nah, this has to be there if these are the types of matchups you're going to get. Because if you are not able to feast on these, the offense gets very shaky. And just in general, if OKC isn't able to puncture gaps that they have, particularly the ones that Shea doesn't create, it can get dicey. Because it was funny watching how dominant they looked early on. And Shea goes to the bench, and immediately Minnesota goes on a run. It was Shea plus the bench. Like, all right, cool. We're going to put 2 on Shea. Let's see what the rest of y'all can do. Didn't hit the same once the second unit came in. All right, cool. Early second quarter is Jalen Williams plus the bench. Jaden McDaniels is now on Jalen Williams. We might put 2 to the ball here, too. All right, let's see what the rest of you are going to do. Oh, no. Like, I came away from that game kind of where wondering, what exactly does this second unit look like in a playoff setting? Because I think one of the quieter hallmarks of like the Shea MVP case is that OKC blows teams out of the water when he's on the floor. And when he's off the floor, there's a pretty bit of a dip. There's a pretty big dip there. It felt super loud in this one. And so that stood out to me in this game. And that also kind of goes into like one of the bigger questions I have about OKC moving forward. Because I do think this team can contend. I think they're that good. I would like for them to feel a little bit better with Shea off the floor than what they do and be able to create advantages at a higher rate without Shea on the floor.
Now, I got a question for you. Is this an overall OKC concern or is this a Minnesota's defense is very good type beat?
It's yes, just because not many teams can have like Jaden McDaniels, who he hasn't even been the version of himself we saw last year. But not many teams can have Jaden McDaniels get in foul trouble and then here comes N'Keal Alexander Walker. Like, not a lot of teams can do that. So I do recognize some of this is just Minnesota has the best defense in basketball. But I do think just in terms of OKC in particular, against good teams, they will see a lot of switches. And more teams are starting to play with, let's put our big wing on Chet so we can turn to Shea Chet, pick and roll to a switch. Once you, when you have that, plus we're going to play off of Josh Giddey, Jalen Williams shooting extremely well from three this year. But I do want, like, okay, what exactly are those closeouts going to look like in a playoff setting? Because while he's shooting well, it's not like he's taking 8-9 threes a game yet. This is a pretty big jump from last year. And in addition to that, would you rather him take those shots versus Jalen Williams is getting downhill as he has been one of the best drivers in basketball? And so, like, Minnesota, again, I think Minnesota highlighted it in a way that other teams can't, but it is like a general, ooh, what else, if that makes sense?
My counter is it goes back to how Oklahoma City plays. And for me, it ties into Minnesota's defense. I thought they were active. I thought they gave great effort. They were working to contain the ball. The problem for Minnesota, when they were able to see everything in front and load up, everything looked really, really good. OKC mixing the cuts, Minnesota had to adjust to that. When Rudy had to try and scram switch, sometimes they hit him with a cut. Minnesota tried to figure that part of it out. But I think the overwhelming thing is Minnesota tried a lot of different things. But you have to keep guarding OKC. And that's the tough part philosophically. Even if they wanted to go two on the ball or drop or we go under, fine. Once the ball gets out of our hands, you need to recover and rotate because a drive is coming and a cut is coming. And that, for me, is going to be the balance for OKC. Can they maintain that style? And I think this is why this piece of the season is so important for them to understand, even when we're not shooting well. Like, think about it. OKC wins this game 39% from the field, 33% from three, 32 made field goals, 21 assists. Did it ever feel like they stopped playing their style?
I think the closest we even got to that was like early slash mid third quarter, where it got a little quick shot happy. And we saw some of the live ball turnovers from OKC. Like, that's probably the closest pocket. But to your general point, like, it's not a thing that happens to OKC a bunch. Like, even when they lose, it's not because they've been completely thrown off of what they're trying to accomplish or what their game plan is. It's very much we miss shots or we turn the ball over. But it's not because we have deviated from who we are.
And that's the part where I hear what you're saying, but until I see that portion of the program, I hold a certain amount of belief in OKC. Because of the way that they've adjusted to what defenses have tried to throw at them. That's where I'm kind of like, you know, yes, but also, they can get got, as we've seen on this road trip. The drives aren't there. Teams are able to switch. Teams are able to score on the other end. It can get interesting. But I don't necessarily feel as if their philosophy is going to be threatened right now.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, it's very much just kind of keeping that, I guess just keeping the effectiveness up. Because to your point, like, they haven't been thrown off of what we want to do. I do worry about it just becoming more difficult to do efficiently in a playoff setting. And that's where I kind of highlight, all right, what exactly are these Chet drives going to look like? Especially if he's going to be playing some minutes without Shea. If they do tighten the rotation, they flip who's going to be on the court at once. Because I would imagine, like, once we get into the actual playoffs, if they do try to shorten things, it'll probably be like Jalen and Chet plus bench versus just Jalen and a bunch of bench players. So I do just wonder, like, okay, what kind of advantages are you two going to create together? Not that they can't, but can you establish that before we get to the actual playoffs? Like, what is that going to look like? And then defensively, there's so much, like, I've been impressed, but like, there's so much strain on Jalen Williams this year. Like, the offense is obviously popped, but like, Jalen Williams just having to defend Cat and defend Naz Reid. Like, I do in the back of my mind kind of like, okay, it might not matter now as he's in the midst of averaging 20 and shooting 60 from the field. Is that going to add up by the time we get to March and April? And like, how is that going to affect the drives? How is that going to affect the cuts? How is that going to affect the defense overall? Like, that could just be me galaxy branding it, but like, I do wonder, like, okay, he's having to defend a lot of bigger players, as OKC overall isn't a very big group. Is that going to eventually weigh on some of these guys that they're going to need to pop in a playoff setting? And so, like, we were having a discussion, we get into a little bit of trade talk with OKC, we were having a discussion during the watch party about, like, Cam Johnson and a few others. Like, if OKC did want to add someone, I think it's been strongly established by now, they are not going to make a mid-season star trade. They're not about to throw six picks and stuff for, like, Laurie Markkanen, and I don't think he's available anyway, et cetera. If they do go mid-tier, let's get one of the Nets forwards. Let's get a Dorian, let's get a Cam, or let's get a Royce, or whatever the case might be. Is it worth cashing in some of the stuff to get one of those guys in? One, because they're good and can help you on both ends. But just for, let's alleviate some of the pressure off of these young guys that we're going to need to average 20 plus. Would that be worth it for you?
No. I'm still in wait and see mode. Find out, is it the shooting that's going to cost you? Is it the defense that's going to cost you? What are we changing? Why are we moving anything? We're not really supposed to be here.
That's true, and that's fair. Like, I think when you are, again, like, I'm not in the camp of let's cash in literally everything for a star and let's make the push for a title now. Obviously, the roster that they have right now is the second seed in the West, and they are a game behind Minnesota, and they just beat Minnesota. They could be the top seed in the West right now. So there's not a dire need for it. I think what makes it unique for OKC is because they do have, like, the big salary in Davis Bertans. To where, like, they can afford to, in a literal sense, they can afford to get someone like one of those Nets forwards or something like that without disrupting their core rotation right now or, like, sending those guys out. He could legit be an addition to the room versus a replacement, and then maybe you find out it doesn't work, and now it's like, oh, snap, now we got to pivot again. So, like, I think they have room to do that, which is why I wanted to see, like, where you were with that. But in general, not that, like, a Royce would help this particular portion to a massive degree, but the big Achilles heel for OKC right now, because of the lack of size, like, they are not a good rebounding team. It's not a team that crashed the offensive glass. They're towards the bottom of the league in defensive rebound rate, towards the bottom of the league in rebound rate overall. Minnesota was able to win the possession battle. Well, they were able to win the rebound battle, rather. They did not win the possession battle because they turned the ball over 20 times, which, watching those, because I saw the box score naturally before watching that game, it's like, oh, this is a lot. I want to see how this happens. It's just reckless stuff. It's odd stuff. It's, as much as I love Naz Reid, boy, did he come through in the second quarter and third quarter in particular. Just travels. And it's just like, man, like, we've talked a little bit about Minnesota's offense and what that's going to look like in a playoff setting. There's going to be an emphasis on, like, what does Cat do against fours offensively? Like, will the drives be contained if he sees help? Will he be able to beat that help with the pass? We know in terms of pure ability, he can obviously pass out of double teams. What type of pass is he going to pick? What is the degree of difficulty on those passes, et cetera? They have to take care of the ball at a higher degree before even getting into it. It's just decision-making for Minnesota for me. I think it's where it boils down to. I think the defense is the best in basketball. I think Ant can take over a game whenever. Like, outside of the Thunder game, like, Mike Conley has made timely shot after timely shot after timely play after timely shot this year. I don't worry about that portion. I need them to have a consistent plan late in games, and I need them to take care of the basketball. And I think if they're able to do both of those things, like, they are set up for a run. But, like, that's just kind of what I want to see from them moving forward.
I think Minnesota has done a fantastic job of answering a lot of the questions that I had coming into the season and earning the right to be number one right now. I think the defense has jumped off the page. Rudy Gobert has done a very good job of defending in space. And so it's not just flipping a matchup. We've seen him do that before. We've seen teams do that before. It's his timing. It's his effort. It's the multiple efforts. It's showing help, recovering to the three, being able to contain a drive and still contest. That's really big for them, not just in the regular season, but in a playoff context. Karl Anthony Towns has answered a lot of questions as far as being able to fight and face some of those switches. Now, the interesting part is in this OKC game, we saw moments where, hey, we got pick and roll. They're switching. Let's get you a catch by the elbow or near the free throw line.
Yeah.
Get you outside away from the three-point line. I think that's the key for him. The closer he is to the basket, the more effective, the more patient he can be, the more powerful he can be on those drives. When he's out against the three-point line, it feels like that turbo button is going to come into play. We also saw where Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was switched onto him and it ended up being a turnover trying to get him the ball in the post. That's something they have to make sure they get done. Anthony Edwards done a great job, I think, with the playmaking. Some nights we see aggressive turbo mode driving. Some nights we're looking for the shot. Sometimes we're looking for the decision-making pick and roll. The problem is, has he done enough? If I'm a coach, do I not just walk in the meeting and say we're playing drop or we're switching?
I think we're closer to what we've ever been with him. I think second round onward, I think you're fine with, okay, let's play drop until he forces us to do something different. I don't think we're at the point where it's immediate now. We need to make sure he's uncomfortable.
So that to me is where, especially because this is a Minnesota team that does have movement. They do have good flow. They found a lot of good actions with their core pieces together. They can bog down. And so if we're going to bog down into Anthony Edwards pick and roll, and now that's a drop or Kat's a switch or Rudy's an automatic switch, that could be an issue. And so I'm in this weird place with Minnesota where they've done literally every single thing I asked them or was waiting on or was unsure about at the start of the season. They have checked every single box off. But now when you go into a playoff context, there's still very specific things that a team could point to against them. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's like, okay, if the defense slips at all and you still have some of these offensive problems, it's less their fault and more my defensive brain saying, I think we can find a way to take one of these pieces off the table. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Edwards or whether it's Karl Anthony Towns, I think we can get one of them to be uncomfortable. And is that all we have to do? Mm-hmm.
I think if you're fleshing that out, like we've seen, because he is a super talented, but also just a young guy, like Ant can press if things aren't going well early. And with Kat, we have years of evidence that if he feels like he's not getting the calls he needs or deserves, et cetera, like that could very much be a frustration deal for him. And so even beyond the schematics, like, okay, we can bother him early. We might be able to affect him in the third quarter because he's still frustrated about what happened in the first half. But to your point about moving Kat around, like I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to, if you didn't, getting him touches around the middle of the floor, getting him those elbow touches and him being able to take one dribble and get downhill. I think he got some good reps against OKC in this one. That's been a year-long thing for Minnesota. And it's funny, as we talk about kind of their offensive process late, it's been funny kind of watching them kind of default to, all right, well, if y'all don't have it right now, or if the last couple of sessions haven't gone well, let's clear aside for Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert. Y'all have chemistry. Mike knows what to do. He's trustworthy with the ball. y'all get us something good. And so it's funny kind of like having that in my mind while watching this game, but then also seeing Minnesota go Chicago action. Like, all right, let's inbound this to Rudy. Jaden McDaniels, you're a screener, so they can't help off of you. Here comes Ant, now spaced on the opposite side of the floor. It's Kat at the wing, and it's Mike Conley in the corner. It's like, oh. And Ant is very comfortable driving to his left. It's like, okay. It's not as basic as like the clear empty side pick roll with Conley and Gobert, but like, okay, this is something that gets Ant going to a comfortable hand for him. He's driving to a comfortable side. You have your best two shooters in his face. So if you do show help, it's a super easy read for him to make as a passer. He's like, okay, like not necessarily advocating for them to run that 18 times a game, like every team in the league runs Chicago or Zoom or whatever you call it. But it's like, okay, they do have stuff that they can kind of lean on. And it helps that as Kat has gotten more comfortable as a driver, we know Ant can get downhill. If you can tilt your defense, Mike Conley can get downhill. And even if you're playing drop against him, you can get to those floaters or pull-ups whenever. Nas Reed come off the bench, he can get downhill. They do have multiple avenues to hit you offensively. They don't have to be the Pacers offensively, especially when your defensive foundation is as strong as it is. So I don't think anyone should be pressing the big red button on Minnesota. They do have answers. And again, with this game in particular, like Mike Conley made a shot. If he makes two, this is different. If Anthony Edwards makes his free throws at the end of this game, this result is different. I don't know if like the conversation we're having changes since we are more so on the process and the concepts of what Minnesota's trying to do. But like even with that result, like they're right there. And I think it's encouraging. It's frustrating because you don't want to leave points on the board. You definitely don't want to turn the ball over that way. And I do think, just zooming out, they can't be in the bottom, towards the bottom of the league in turnover rate when this is a team that already doesn't play super fast to begin with. They have to be able to take care of the ball and get good looks and get cracks at it. But it is encouraging that they can play an OKC like this and have that many miscues and have a chance to send it to overtime. They are the one seed for a reason in the West. So I'm still very much encouraged by what I've seen from Minnesota. I have the offense questions. I guess just very quickly, since I asked the trade thing with Minnesota, I mean with OKC, is there a player type that you would like to see them target before we hit February 8th? Or is this a let's grow internally type deal for you with Minnesota?
Man, you know me. Grow internally. We got the pieces. We have it through the season. You know me. I'm not a trade guy. We still trying to find minutes for Shake Milton and Troy Brown in big games. Like, no. We got our guys. We just got to be better. We got to do a better job of executing. This is the unit. This is the group. We've gotten this far. I don't know if it's external. And I might be a caveman, but that's just me. Do you have a target for Minnesota?
I think for me, like if they had a movement shooter, I would feel better. Obviously, as we talk about Minnesota within a playoff context, it would have to be someone that can hit shots off movement and also defend well enough to make that matter. But like if I just look at the roster, who's in the rotation, like they don't really have one of those. They have guys that can knock down shots. Mike Conley has been a high-level three-point shooter. Is he flying off of staggers and wide pins and firing off movement like that? Like, that's not necessarily the bag for him. Not that he can't, but that's just not his usage. So, like, if they had someone that can tilt things that way, even if it's just for the second unit, just kind of loosen some things there in the half court. Like, I would like that for them. Outside of that, that's probably the big thing. Also, can I just give a very quick note just based off this game? Always makes the heart smile when Jordan McLaughlin gets minutes. That dude gets after it. Enjoy him defensively. He made big shots. And to the Jaden front, which, you know, eyes are going to be on him with the defensive role that he has. And as the contract kicks in next season, you're going to want another step from him offensively, just overall. Man, he hit some big shots in that first half to keep Minnesota in it when OKC landed that initial haymaker. A pair of threes, got an and one. He missed the free throw, though. He really kept them afloat. And then defensively, as OKC went to that Jalen plus bench unit, his defense on Jalen Williams was incredible. Just wanted to give him the hat tip there. But these are some fun teams, man. If you want to see good defense, watch a Minnesota game. You want to watch some fun offense with OKC, they are cutting and driving all over the place and knocking down shots. I like this one.
Shocker. All right, so who do you believe in more, Minnesota or OKC?
Slight lean to OKC right now. I feel like okay. When this was asked like a month ago, I was like Minnesota because of the defense and the rebounding. I think I go slight lean with OKC right now.
Okay.
What say you, good
sir? Hey, Nikias. For me, I'm Minnesota. I like defense. So defense wins for me right now. Defense and experience, they've been through this before. Let's play a game, Nikias.
Okay.
It's called I Ball Up the Show Sheet and Make Some Stuff Up on the Fly. What do you think about the Los Angeles Clippers and their ability to play small? Coming off a night where they beat the Brooklyn Nets by going with Russell Westbrook, Norman Powell, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, James Harden. Does that lineup move you?
It moves me and it also scares me. And I say scares me because that group is so small. And like, there are some fine rebounders in that group. But like, I guess for me, it's just like, how many of the West top teams can they deploy that group against? Would be my question. And this is just off the top of my head.
Ironically enough, you ready to get mad at me?
What's up?
Minnesota and OKC.
Yeah, probably fair. Like you give like Kawhi the cat matchup, and like have Rudy do your best, and kind of go from there. Paul George on Ant. Like, yeah.
Might give it to James.
Well, yeah. If James Harden can't do anything else defensively, the post defense will be there. So you could do that. And then with OKC, depending on, oh, that's the other thing I didn't bring up during that game. Like, Josh Giddey didn't close that game. OKC won the run afterwards. Just basketball perspective, if you're at a point where it's early in his career, obviously, but if you feel like you just can't close with him, like, I think the noise is going to get a little bit louder on, is he going to be the chip when we eventually make a bigger move? Will he be the guy? Seems to be pointing that way. But anyway, yeah, you could probably do that against OKC. You could do that against Minnesota. Can you do it against Denver? I guess is kind of where my mind went.
No, you can't. You could try it, but I don't think you would want to. That feels very much we're in danger. I mean, you could, in an ideal world, you could try it. I don't know. I mean, the funniest part of this could be, like, what if James Harden is, like, the hack for Jokic somehow? I feel like that'd be funny, but...
It would be funny. Yeah, I feel like they tried... I got you. Like, I feel like they tried that, the November matchup with Denver and LA? Like, I know they closed super small, and Denver ended up winning that game. I'm trying to remember if that was the exact five or if someone was in for Norm. Like, if they had Terrence Mann in instead of Norm or something like that. I'm trying to think of that off the top of my head. Like, I remember them going, like, Kawhi at the five against Denver, and they eventually won that one, so... They clearly aren't afraid to go small against the group, but yeah, we'll see.
I have another one for you.
Okay.
So, the Phoenix Suns. Are you moved by a lineup of Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, Eric Gordon, Grayson Allen? Because we are coming off a night where they told the Indiana Pacers, hey, Buddy Hield, you come over here, buddy. Get it?
You come over here, buddy. You reckon?
They switched. They scored. Then they decided we're not switching anymore. It's show and recover. And the Suns had all the room in the world to operate. Does that lineup move you?
It does, because they have threats everywhere. I worry about them using it in January. I think for me,
What happened to experimentation, man? What?
No, I want them to experiment. I guess for me, it's just like considering what the bench has been for them this year. It's just like, can you sprinkle that in moderation? Because I think in the playoffs, they can absolutely close with that group. And honestly, I'll have to go back through my notes. I'm not going to do that live. But I feel like that was one of, if not the lineup I chose for, like, lineup that intrigues me the most when we did season preview stuff. So, like, I'm not anti the lineup. It's just like, okay, how much are y'all going to have to go to this? And can y'all do that without worrying about KD picking up something or Devin Booker picking up something or Bradley Beal picking up something? That's it's more so a health deal, not a how good is the lineup deal.
Okay. I like it. Very good. I just wanted to salute Phoenix. Also, I have a question for you. Philadelphia 76ers, rolling right team. Now. Five straight wins. Half game out of the 2 seed. Do you believe in the improvements they've made with their movement and Joel Embiid's passing and the placement where he's at on the court? Is that strong enough for you with Maxey's play to stamp them?
Yeah, frankly. Like, I think if they stay healthy, like we did the Bleacher Report exercise last week, and my Eastern Conference Finals right now is Boston-Philly. Like, I think they have shown enough variety just from a scheme perspective. Like, they can move and beat enough to where you can't really load up on him the way that you want to, in addition to him just being super good. Yeah, I think they've shown enough so far. Now, again, we got 2 weeks before the trade deadline. We'll see if they actually do something. Like, their name's been linked to a bunch of different guys. So we'll see if they try to bolster the bench, if they actually get into, like, the DeJounte Murray hunt in earnest. I don't know where that ends. But as currently constructed, I think Tyrese Maxey's done very well. He's played very well. He's going to be an all-star. Joel Embiid has just been, like, at worst, a top 2 player in the league this year. This is one of the most dominant, high-volume scoring seasons in NBA history. And then, as you mentioned, the passing has also gotten better. Like, that's enough of a foundation in and of itself. Then you get to the defense. Defense has also been good. So, I mean, yeah.
Perfect. And it segues perfectly into the return of the segment where I tell Nakia something that broke while we recorded so he doesn't get annoyed. Phoenix Suns forward Kevin Durant and Philadelphia 76ers center Joel Embiid have been named the NBA Western and Eastern Conference Players of the Week, respectively, for week 13 of the 2023-24 season.
Dog, when I tell you my heart dropped when you said Phoenix Suns forward Kevin Durant after we just talked about, I like the lineup, I just don't want him to be overworked. I'm like, please don't tell me that, man. It's listed as questionable with ankle soreness or something. I'm like, don't do this to me. But no, shout out to KD, who just dropped a clean 40 on Indy. 40 with no free throws. So how does that work? Is that an ethical 40 ball?
Isn't it the most ethical?
It's funny that comes against Pascal then, huh?
Yeah, speaking of, solid debut for Pascal Siakam. Boy, that fit in the transition fit is incredible.
Oh yeah,
you can really feel the opportunities that he has early in the clock with how they play, get up and down the court. He can push it sometimes, but hey, I can get a post up real quick. No one's here, no one's loaded up. Oh, I can push it, pass it, and get it back real quick, and now I can drive. That jumps off the page. He might be the best five defensively for them right now. Don't yell at me.
Can I raise my hand? I'm not going to yell at you.
But what's up?
Not the clean note. I was just going to say, I don't know if you're wrong, but like that's also part of the problem. If there is a very quick takeaway very early on with the Pascal and Indy, boy, that defense is still, goodness gracious, because Portland was still able to, oh man, we'll save it for another day, but oh man.
All right, got another question for you, buddy.
Okay.
What are you more moved by? The Cleveland Cavaliers having won 9 of their last 12 games and 8 of their last 10 and 7 straight, or the New York Knicks with OG Anunoby, who apparently just keep winning?
It's probably Cleveland by default because I didn't see this. And man, Cleveland's defense has been so fun. Like, you talked about Jared Allen the other week, how much more aggressive he's been offensively. The defense has obviously been very good for him. Isaac Coral has been flying all around the place. They still just have like a collective. They still just have like a collective size about them with Cleveland, even without Evan Mobley, to where like they're still able to shrink the floor against you. They're still able to turn you over. I'm very impressed they've been able to do this with the injuries they've dealt with.
Well, if you're a true dunker, you would have watched the December 21st episode that was on YouTube, and you wouldn't be surprised because I told you what Cleveland could do. So listen to me when I say things. Anyways, moving right along.
Okay.
DeJounte Murray and his game-winning shot tour. Are you moved?
If I'm not moved, he sure will be.
Ah. It's well done. Well done.
We did it. No, shout out to DeJounte. Also, I go on that whole Hawks rant and then they just don't lose anymore. Like that's a good bit.
You timed that up pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, they did just lose to the Cavs, so you know.
Yeah.
Kind of good. They did sandwich you though. Another question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Utah or Houston? It's only gonna be one of them. Which one? Which one do you believe in?
It's gonna be Utah for me, big dog.
Really? Okay. Are you ready for the Golden State run?
So when you say Golden State run, what does that mean?
They're 2 games out. They're 2 games out of the play-in, guys. Are you ready?
I mean, I guess. Well, sure.
4 game home. Just saying, keep an eye on it. Got you. Let's see. Did you have any other questions for me? I might have hit the end of my segment.
I see. You asked about the Clippers and their lineup. Like, LA is your... Are they the best team in the West for you?
It's still Denver for me. I have Clippers Nuggets probably as my conference finals as things shake out today.
Makes sense. Very quickly, like, where does New Orleans factor into the West for you right now?
Depends on where they land. in all honesty. Mm-hmm. They have the potential to make a run. I'm trying to figure out where that run is best kept at. Because, I mean, look, here's the thing. The Western Conference, it's going to be tough. And the matchups are going to be tough. And so if New Orleans is the 5 seed, Clippers matchup doesn't seem ideal, but it could be fun. But then again, they're only a game ahead of 8. So they could be in a play-in, win and get in, and then face OKC type deal. So it's really hard to place them. In a playoff context, I like them. I don't think you want to face them because of the talent they have, because of the defense they can play, and because of the flow they can hit. I think that the work that they have done may hit more in a playoff context than they've been able to hit the keynotes in the regular season. I think that travels well. I just look top to bottom. Actually, I'll ask you this.
Okay.
Because this is a metric that I like to use. How many teams in the West would genuinely surprise you if they made a run to the conference finals? Just genuinely, this shocks me.
Genuinely, they would just shock me. Let me pull up the standards real quick. So obviously, it would be within the teams that are in the playoff / play-in picture. Like duh, the Spurs would shock me, et cetera.
Well, yeah, top 10. I'm at 9 right now.
You're at 9. That wouldn't surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, well, I'm going to say Minnesota wouldn't surprise me. OKC wouldn't surprise me. Denver, I literally have going to the finals. Clippers wouldn't surprise me. Honestly, after those 4, it probably gets into mild surprise. Or I guess maybe not even surprise. It'd be more so like, okay, I didn't have this, but I see how it happened type beat.
This man put tears on the surprise.
You know who you're doing the pod with. I don't know what you.
Would you be surprised? No, but also. This man gave me a tier subgroup, man.
Look, man, I'm trying my best. I guess 7 would be the true answer to the heart of your question.
All right, so that is that's a shot at Sacramento and the Lakers.
Like I don't see it for this Lakers group.
You Euroed Sacramento.
Honestly, the issue is that I'm just in a weird place with Sacramento and also New Orleans. Is the bit.
Oh, you don't believe in either of them. Okay.
It's less that. Like, I just don't know which version of New Orleans I'm going to get. And then with Sacramento, like, the defense is better, but it still ain't good. It also didn't help that, like, we just have. This has been a weird Kevin Herter year on top of that. So I feel like they would be, if we're actually going through the tiers, like, that would be I wouldn't be surprised if they win a round in the playoffs and then push Team X to 6 or 7. What kind of be where they'll be at? I don't want to go. I don't think they should be fully disrespected in the playoff front. I guess they're closer to that than I can see conference finals. Like, I don't know if I'm all the way there with those two yet. And like, Phoenix ain't that far ahead of them, honestly, just because of, again, second unit's been weird. They are an injury away from being weird. So.
Okay, I'll ask one last question, and that'll be it.
Sure. Okay.
Because I feel like in the East, I can already, it's probably, you're probably at 4 in the East.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I'm assuming that's Big 3 plus Miami. Is that right?
It might be Big 3 plus New York at this point.
Excuse me? Are you ill?
I'm not ill. You know what's ill? Miami's offense.
You said New York?
So here's the thing. We can flesh this out very quickly. It's right at the end of the pod. It feels like every January, the Heat go through the same cycle to where they are either sick as the mid-January flu or whatever goes around, and or something falls off a cliff. It may be just the shooting. It may be just on-ball defense. It may just be off-ball defense. It may be a string of injury / sickness. Something falls off a cliff from Miami every January, it feels like. And if there's a Dunker / Heat fan listening to this, look up some stuff for me. We'll get this together. But it just feels like every January something falls apart. Sure enough, Heat have lost their last 3. The offense has been awful. Has been awful. And as we've talked about earlier this year, the defense just hasn't felt right this year. I think Bam overall has been tremendous. But like beyond him, I haven't loved the on-ball defense from Miami. They have not been able to contain drives at a high level at all. And it's just like, it can't be both of those things. It can't be very bad offense. And then also we can't get stops or we can't contain the ball. And so like, I'm just, I think the OG version of the Knicks, like the defense has really perked up for them. Offensively, like Jalen Brunson remains very good. Julius Randle has been very good. OG filling gaps. Like, I think they still need to make a move with their second unit. I think that's a lot of strain on Julius plus bench. I've enjoyed the Deuce McBride experience, but I don't know if you want to put that on him in a playoff setting to, like, legitimately run stuff for you. Like, it's hard not to feel better about what the Knicks are doing right now versus what the Heat are doing right now. So the real answer would probably just be 5. But, like, if I have to choose 4, it'd probably be New York as of January 22nd versus Miami.
Wow, I'm impressed. I got Nekias to deliver some Knicks love while also giving his annual What's Up With The Heat version of the rant, in which I will once again remind him that they are who they are. Their success is their success. They have reached a point where Bam Adebayo is getting double teamed. That eventually should be a positive for them.
Do anything with it?
Easy there, come by. Easy. There are positives. They can always play zone. The defense activity can perk up and down.
Like, you're not wrong, to be clear. Like, as a leaning into the bit, but like you're not wrong. Like, it feels ugly now because it always feels ugly around this time. We're gonna hit March and Miami's gonna win 7 of 10, and the defense is gonna feel even better. They're gonna start containing drives, and then it's like, okay, this is the Heat that I envisioned heading into the year. But like right now, they're not playing like that. So it's just like, okay, well, this sucks. I don't like this. This doesn't seem positive. Like, it's weird stuff going on with Kyle Lowry. Hame's been out for a while. Jimmy's been in and out. So it's a bunch of stuff happening at once. So naturally, this doesn't feel very Miami-ish, but it's January. This also just feels like the weird period of the NBA season between Christmas and All-Star, where things just kind of fall off and then teams kind of refresh after February. So this is why I'm not saying Miami's done. They can't do it. It's just like, nah, it feels bad right now. But if you don't have anything else, do we want to do like rapid fire news / free throws?
I mean, I'm all out. So you do whatever you'd like.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, we'll go quickly on some of these. Maybe I'll carry over some of my actual free throws to the next pod. But per ESPN's Andrea Carter, first the Sparks announced that they court Jordan Canada. And then shortly after, we get the report from ESPN's Andrea Carter that the likely outcome is going to be a signing trade for Jordan Canada. So that was interesting and surprising. And then Jordan Canada sends out a tweet where it's just like, you know what happens when you assume. So I don't know what that means. I don't know what any of that means. I don't know if this means Jordan Canada and the Sparks are about to work something out or if there's actually about to be a signing trade. But I'll quickly toss it to you. If Jordan Canada does not return to the Sparks, where would you like to see her?
Connecticut.
Okay. I would like to see her in Atlanta. Quick hat tip to Jasmine Thomas, who retired, one of the best on-ball defenders in WNBA history. She's now set to become the new director of player programs and development with the Dallas Wings, so that should be fun. While we're on Dallas, Awat Queer foregoing the 2024 season. Going to take a break. Question for you, does this mean that Dallas is going to draft another big?
No, they won't. They did it last year.
I hope that is the end of it. We didn't go over the last All-Star update on the last pod, but starters are pretty much static. Tyrese Halliburton, Trae Young, who's now, or as of last check, roughly 86,000 votes ahead of Damian Lillard for the second guard spot. Jason Tatum, Giannis, and Embiid. In the West, it's Luka and Steph. Though the gap between Steph and Shea closing a little bit. LeBron, KD, and Jokic, do you anticipate any changes among the starting units when they are announced on Thursday?
The Shea thing is interesting. If Shea's close enough in voting, I think he gets media. The players, it'll probably be up to them. So I said I'd be shocked if it wasn't Luka and Steph. There's a chance it might not be. I would still be surprised, but I'm keeping an eye on that in the East backcourt.
Okay. I would just be surprised if, like I said this the other day, like I'd be surprised if Trey holds on. Because the players aren't super kind to him, or they haven't been in prior votes, so we'll keep an eye on that. And then some quick free throws from my end. If the neck of the New York rumblings actually proved to be true, how excited will you be, sir?
Hashtag depends.
Hashtag
truly,
depends.
Truly, truly, truly depends.
Hmm. So if it was her, but Jonquel goes to Seattle, how would you feel about it?
Hashtag depends.
All right, fair enough. If you could only sign one, would you rather have Alana Smith or Beck Allen?
It depends on what team I am.
The nuance, man.
I mean, context is important. I mean, I'd probably just straight up go Rebecca Allen because of the versatility. But Alana hooped.
Okay, got you. Is Giannis about to have the best fourth place MVP finish of all time?
No. Still feel like we got some games played shenanigans that are up in the air. But it is very high potential.
Gotcha.
Very high potential.
Okay. Well, last one I have for you. I'll save the rest for Thursday. Who's the Suns' best player?
Devin Booker, Kevin Durant.
That is not how that works. What is that?
What you mean?
That's not one person. What is that?
Buffalo. Kevin Durant, Devin Booker.
It's KD. Okay. You got it. Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. And if you are watching this on JJ Redick's YouTube channel and are not surprised to JJ Redick's YouTube channel, you should probably subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel. We are here every Tuesday. And in general, there's a ton of great content on the channel overall. You have a lot of fun as a basketball fan, so check that out. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun discussions in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you would like to watch basketball with us, live analysis, we get breakdowns through commercial breaks, going through film, late game stuff. We got Steve breaking down why a play did or didn't work. And in general, very much an inclusive, wholesome community. You can let your hair down, talk about life stuff as well. So if you want to rock with us, watch some games with us, and just hang with us in general, the link should be in the podcast description, should be hyperlinked. If so, enter your information. If you have a League Pass subscription / cable subscription, you should be good to go. Come rock with us. It is a ton of fun. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Hey, Nikias, great show. Hey, you'd have to send that 3 times too, right?